Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Hello. A quick message to let you know that this week's books podcast includes instances of offensive language.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead. This week we're looking at stories and who owns them. John Boyne takes ambition in the literary world to almost parodic levels in A Ladder to the Sky. And Sarah Waters describes the agonies and, if you're very lucky, the ecstasies of seeing your beloved story reborn on screen as the film of her book, The Little Stranger, arrives in cinemas. But first.
The winner of the Forward Prize for Best Collection 2018 is Dana Smith.
It's autumn. Exciting time, known by the French as La Rentrée, the return. Here in England, we have the Booker Shortlist and the Forward Poetry Prizes. I'm here today in the studio with Sian Kane. Sian, I know you are pretty excited about the Booker dozen, as we know them, the 13 books on the long list. What do you make of this shortlist?
Well, my verdict is it's sort of an impossibility in that I don't think the judges could have ever done anything that would have made me really, really happy. Because you have 13 books on this year's long list and then it's always whittled down to 6 on the short list.
Can you just say why you're excited about the 13?
Well, it was a bit of a exciting one because of the new elements to it. So first of all, there was a thriller, which personally, the book itself, Snap by Belinda Bauer, wasn't for me, but I was very glad to see it there just because it shook things up a little bit. Also, the presence of the first ever graphic novel to be longlisted for the prize, which is Sabrina by Nick Dranasso, which I loved. So that was very exciting. And also the presence of how many young writers.
Your age.
Yeah, my age. There's a lot of people sort of, you know, late 20s, early 30s, often for their first book, perhaps their second. There were 5 on this year's long list. So 5 out of 13 is like a pretty hefty presence for young people. And so that was really, really exciting for me.
So how many of them have actually survived the cut?
1. So 1 of the 6. And I have to have my little caveat here. A very close friend of mine, Daisy Johnson, is shortlisted, youngest ever author shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize.
How old is she?
She's 27. She's a month younger, almost exactly a month younger than Eleanor Catton, who won the prize in 2013 for her novel The Luminaries. Eleanor was 27 when she was shortlisted and then was 28 when she won. And Daisy will still be 27 if she wins in October.
So
her birthday's on 31st of October, so she will win it 2 weeks.
How likely do you think she is to win?
I mean, as a friend, I want to go, yes, absolutely, 100% she's going to win. I actually really, really loved her novel, all nepotism aside. I think her novel is Everything Under is absolutely beautiful. She's just got such a unique prose style. It sort of tumbles out, but it also feels very effortless. And I think just the inventiveness as well of what she's doing, sort of reimagining Oedipal myth in modern Britain is fabulous, and such a sort of ambitious and accomplished book for someone who's 27. I think that's sort of, we should hold these books up. And I know some people will be cynical about her age, and I also understand why people don't want to put too much emphasis on her age, because it should be about the achievement itself rather than at which point in your life that you do it. But she should be absolutely praised and held up for her ambition at her age.
So she's one of, you know, the great thing about this list is you can cut it in many different ways. Mm. You say, well, she's, you know, the only under 30-year-old who has survived the cut. But there are 2 Americans and a Canadian on this list.
Yes, and then 3 people from the UK.
3 people.
Well, one is Irish. Mm-hmm. So Anna Burns is Irish.
Yeah, Northern Irish.
But Northern Irish.
Yes.
And so and that's interesting as well, because there were three Irish writers on the list, and Anna Burns is the only one to survive there. And we've lost Sally Rooney,
yeah.
Which is, you know, it's that everybody is talking about Sally Rooney's Normal People, and off she goes. Yeah. Donald Ryan as well.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. So basically, when I said at the start that this, if we're sort of in an impossible situation, I'm excited about what is on this year's shortlist, and I'm very disappointed about what isn't there. They couldn't have had a 13-book shortlist. That's not how these things work. But I do think it's really interesting. So having looked at how these books have been selling, all 13 books on the long list, in terms of the bestsellers, the bestseller by far is Belinda Bauer's Snap, which maybe is to be expected. It is a genre book. It is a thriller. Commercial crime fiction does sell very, very well. It also happens to be out in paperback. So it has sold, I think, roughly around about 53,000 copies just in paperback alone, let alone hardcover before that. Then you've got Michael Ondaatje's Warlight. Michael Ondaatje, of course, is a very well-known author.
He's been knocked off.
But Sally Rooney's Normal People, I think, has sold about 15,000 copies in the last 3 weeks, which is pretty fantastic in hardcover. And then Nick Drenasno's Sabrina, which is like the sort of surprise pick, I think the truly surprising pick on this year's long list. So I think a lot of people went out and bought it to sort of see what it was doing. And all these books aren't on the shortlist. These are all the bestsellers. So I think you have to sort of look at this shortlist and actually ask, what is this prize doing? In that it does feel to me like there is a deliberate effort involved in the curation here to really drive readers towards a particular book. Not a sort of particular book on the shortlist, but I'm sort of saying a particular book that perhaps people weren't already buying. And I don't know if sales are actually taken into account by the judges or whether they really do count the opinions of the reading public when they're curating the shortlist. But I do find it hugely interesting that basically the five best-selling books on this year's long list, none of them are on the shortlist.
My understanding is that sales are not taken into account, but that it is a prize that hopes to stimulate the industry, the bookselling industry.
And I do have to, like, I have to applaud it for that and sort of say it is great to try and drive people to books that perhaps they don't want to try. And as we can actually see with the numbers, people aren't trying these books that are on the shortlist.
So let's just look at a few of them. I mean, Anna Burns' Milkman. Mm. It's very chewy, isn't it?
Yes. So I personally, if you're going to, basically a lot of the books on this year's shortlist are based around themes. There's a lot of very contemporary themes. So particularly here with Anna Burns' Milkman, it looks at basically a very extremely troubling relationship between an 18-year-old girl in Northern Ireland during the Troubles who starts being harassed by an older milkman.
Well, he's a paramilitary who's called the Milkman.
Oh, yes. But he doesn't just harass her, he isolates her, he threatens to kill her boyfriend if she doesn't break up with him. It's all told from her voice, and her voice is, the voice is very lyrical, it's very chewy, as you say. If we were to say, and I don't think this is the case, but if we were to say, right, Sally Rooney's Normal People, which also looks at gender and it looks at issues around power dynamics in relationships, and you have Milkman as well, which is the better book? I'd honestly pick up the Sally Rooney and say this is the better book. Because
you pick it up, but is it the better book? That's not necessarily the same thing.
No, but it's also equally objective. And I would personally say that Sally Rooney is the better book in that it is so succinct and the prose is so clean and clear and it doesn't need the lyricism and the sort of tumbling sentences that go on for ages and the quirks of the voice that exist in Milkman, because I just found it very, very tiring. I didn't find it particularly attractive. It wasn't a kind of a voice that I wanted to keep reading. And while I get that not all books should be like that, I do feel like books should be praised and books should be held up as successes for doing things without show and without flash.
And interesting, the other book, the other extreme almost, is the Essie Adugian, Washington Black, which has this very familiar, very, very measured, it's a slave narrative, it has, but it feels very easy, it's a voice we know.
Yes.
The, absolutely, the very, very easy. It's a smooth read. Although although it covers a lot of big history, it's very thoughtful. It's the sort of slip down easily sort of end of it.
Yeah, and I did, I actually feel like a lot of the characters in Washington Black, she's done a fantastic job in crafting the characters in it. I'm not a massive fan of historical fiction, but I did enjoy what I have read so far of Washington Black.
That was the one I tipped right at the long list
stage. Yes, you did.
I'm very happy that it's got through to the shortlist stage, because you're always a bit worried when you tip something that it's going to damn it forever.
So, well, I've been tipping Rooney for weeks and she's not on the bloody shortlist.
You're the curse.
I cursed it.
So the novel that I hadn't read at the long listing stage was Robin Robertson's The Long Take, which is really interesting. I mean, is it a novel or is it a long poem? I am a bit undecided. It's about an ex-serviceman who's been demobbed, Canadian serviceman who's come out of the war, and he arrives in New York, and it's about the sort of post-war culture clashing with this population of drifters who he's drifted out of a 1930s existentialist novel, and suddenly he's in 1950s New York, and McCarthy's getting going, and the Los Angeles film industry is getting going, and he doesn't know what to make of the modern world. And it's, as Robin Robertson actually cites Walter Friedlander, who is a professor at Berkeley, who says, at last German expressionism meets the American dream. And you kind of think that's what he's aiming to do with this novel stroke epic poem.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Even that, the voice in The Long Take, I think is still more readable and more enjoyable, and I think a greater achievement than Milkman. And I don't mind novel in verse. I don't sort of think it doesn't necessarily stretch the borders of form too much for me. Like, if we're going to say that this is a prize for novels, I don't think novels in verse are necessarily, you know, too crazy, too wild for that. And I've certainly liked what I read in The Long Take, but it's the sort of thing that I think that is actually an example of a sort of prose style that is far more interesting and I think a greater achievement than Milkman. It sounds like I'm ragging on Milkman a lot, but
yeah,
I really
you've been a bit tough on Milkman.
I'm very surprised it's there.
So let's move on then, on to Rachel Kushner, another of the Americans,
yes.
The Mars Room.
I really liked The Mars Room. I think that it's a genuinely new take on a lot of things around sex work and what modern poverty looks like in America, what the justice system is doing to individuals in America. I think Kushner's just a very cool author, and she just has a lot of heft, even though her books are very, very readable. I really like her. Quite pleased she's there.
The sentences are quite short. It's short and
yeah,
snappy.
Yeah, she's very punchy, and she doesn't mess around with ugliness either. She doesn't try to hide. Like, you know, some of the content of this book is quite confronting, but I thought it was a really good novel.
So the one we haven't mentioned so far is Richard Powers' The Overstory. Mm.
Yes, when they were announcing the shortlist, there was a sort of a little preamble by the chair of judges, and then he made reference to one of the books being really long, and I was like, okay, Richard Powers is on there. it's a stonker, this book. It's huge.
A redwood of a novel, as someone has described it.
Well, it's got a lot about trees in it, so that's probably pretty good. I mean, I've only dipped into this just because it was the longest, so, you know. I'm sorry, everyone. I need to spread my reading.
It's got nine characters. It covers a huge time span. It's sort of eco-fable, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I quite like the sort of... It's structured around almost the structure of a tree. There's a part called roots and there's a part called stem. And, you know, it's really... I mean, Richard Powers is sort of famously an environmentalist. And all of his characters... He's got this big cast of characters and it sort of looks at multiple generations of people, but all of them are variously invested in ecology and is sort of particularly centered around the saving of some virgin acres in this a forest in Iowa, I think. So I'm kind of pleased by... It's funny, it's almost like you expect certain books to be on these kind of prize long lists. So I sort of was thinking, oh, Andacci will be there just because he's so well known and he's so... big, and he's had a very big year this year because English Patient was chosen as the Booker of Bookers this year and has won the Booker before, you know, he'll probably be there. And so in the absence of Ondaatje, Richard Powers is almost like my big, stately, American, big American novel, you know, his presence there almost balances things out. Now, that's not to say that I will necessarily like the overstory when I get into it, but it's almost like an understandable presence to me. But maybe that's a problem because I'm expecting it to be there because these books are so often up for these prizes. And,
yeah.
and whether often, they should be or not is debatable.
Well, often in the end, even with these sort of racy, slightly exciting long lists and short lists, it's the big hitter, the
that
blue
win.
Blood that comes through.
And then everyone remembers that and no one ever remembers the short list.
So what's your tip?
Do you know what? I'm going to go for Daisy. Let's do it. Let's give 27-year-olds £50,000, you know? Let's not give it to Richard Powers. I've got nothing against Richard Powers, but let's give my mate Daisy £50,000 so she can take me out for a drink.
You're on. So though Robin Robertson appears on the Booker list as a debut novelist, he's actually a very successful poet who's won all three categories of the Forward Prizes. That's for single poem, for first collection, and for collection of the year. The latest batch were awarded this week at London's Royal Festival Hall. It wasn't that long ago that the organisers caused a storm by hiring in actors to read the shortlisted entries on the basis that poets didn't read well enough to command a big stage. How things change. Danez Smith took the top prize for an explosive second collection exploring the experience of being black, gender neutral and HIV positive in the American Midwest. Here they are, their pronoun of choice, performing a poem from Don't Call Us Dead.
Let's make a movie called Dinosaurs in the Hood. Jurassic Park meets Friday meets The Pursuit of Happiness. There should be a scene where a little boy is on the bus playing with a toy dinosaur, then looks out the window and sees a T-Rex, because there has to be a T-Rex. Duh, it's a dinosaur movie. What the shit did you think was gonna happen? Ugh. Don't let Tarantino direct this. In his version, the boy plays with a gun. The metaphor being black boys toy with their own lives, the spitting image of his father, the foreshadow to his end. Fuck that. The kid is playing with the plastic triceratops or brontosaurus, and this is his proof of magic or God or Santa or some weird freaky lizard Jesus Saint Nick shit. I don't know. I want a scene where a cop car gets pooped on by a pterodactyl. I want a scene where a corner store turns into a battleground, but please don't let the Wayans brothers in this movie. I don't want any racist shit about Asian people or overused pan-Latino stereotypes. This is a movie about a neighborhood of royal folks, the children of slaves and immigrants and addicts and exiles, saving their town from real-ass dinosaurs. I don't want some cheesy yet progressive, sexy Vietnamese hot dude hero with some funny yet strong black girl buddy cop film. This is not a vehicle for Will Smith and Sofia Vergara. I want grandmas, real ass grandmas, on the front porch taking out raptors with the guns they hid in the walls and under mattresses. I want Cecily Tyson to make a speech, maybe two. I want some of those little spitty, screamy dinosaur things to go. I want Viola Davis to save the town in the last scene with a black fist afro pick through the last dinosaur's long scale neck. And this can't be a black movie. No, this movie can't be dismissed because of its cast or its audience. This movie can't be a metaphor for black people and extinction. This movie can't be about race. This movie can't cause black people pain or be about black pain. This movie can't be about a long history of having a long history with hurt. This movie can't be about race. Nobody can say nigga in this movie who can't say it to my face in public. No chicken jokes in this movie. No bullet holes and the heroes, and nobody kills the black boy, and nobody kills the black boy, and nobody kills the black boy for once. Nobody kills that black boy besides The only reason I want to make this is for the first scene anyway. The little black boy on the bus with his toy dinosaur. His eyes wide and endless. His dreams possible and pulsing and bright, right there. Thank you.
The amazing Danez Smith. Not for nothing did they describe themselves that night as feeling like energy wrapped in skin. Thanks to the South Bank Centre for that fabulous recording. Now, many of Sarah Waters' novels, such as Fingersmith or Tipping the Velvet, have been explorations of lesbian life. The Little Stranger was different. It's a gothic novel with a male narrator that focuses on class in post-war Britain rather than sexuality. It's now been made into a film by Lenny Abrahamson. Sian asked Sarah to go back to basics. How much of a departure was the novel from her earlier work?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of was a departure and it wasn't. I mean, it clearly was. There were no gay characters in it. It was the first time I'd had a significant male character, well, a male narrator as well. So I knew that that was new territory for me. I knew that it might slightly disappoint some of my lesbian fans, which I think the book did, really, some of them. But for me, it was very much a continuation of interests I'd already had. You know, most of my books really have a kind of gothic element to them. I mean, this is a bit different. The Little Stranger is a bit different in that it has an actively supernatural element to it. But, you know, the kind of... the large house, which is a sort of repository of secrets, you know, I kind of used before in Fingersmith, and Affinity with the women's prison, you know, this structure that's full of spaces, some of which are forbidden, some of which allow you to enact kind of transgressive desires. They're at the heart of my fiction, really. So I felt very comfortable with The Little Stranger. In fact, it really came to life for me as a project when I realised I could write it as a haunted house story, I think, because I'd grown up reading ghost stories and watching horror films and just felt very at home with the genre and saw it as an opportunity to really enjoy the genre and to make the most of it, relish it.
So, I mean, you mentioned ghost stories, and it's really interesting because, as far as I understand it, this didn't actually necessarily start as a ghost story. You sort of started with a very different motivation, which was looking at the rise of socialism in the UK.
Well, I was interested in what was happening in post-war Britain, you know, the class changes. So I'd written my previous book, The Night Watch, which was set during and just after the Second World War, and I'd really concentrated mainly on gender and sexuality for that. It's about the sort of the strange liberations that people were able to find in wartime and then a slight closing down of possibility that came with the return to peace. But in researching that book, you know, it's impossible to research the 1940s and not come across class because it was such a hot topic at the time. Mm. And of course, coming out of the war, you know, people voting out Churchill, voting in the socialist government, there was this great sense of forward movement, Britain becoming a fairer, more democratic place, which for lots of people was very exciting. And for other people, perhaps especially the landed gentry, you know, who had more of a stake in the old-fashioned world and needed servants and things, it made the world a very unsafe and dejecting and I think quite menacing place. So I was interested in all of that, but no, didn't plan to write a ghost story at first. In fact, I was drawn to a novel called The Franchise Affair by Josephine Tay, which is a fascinating and really quite horrid novel in the sense that it's all about this working class girl called Betty who disappears for a while and claims to have been abducted by two middle-class women. And the story is about the unfolding of this case and ultimately, I'm sorry, this is a spoiler, but, you know, kind of Betty is revealed as this sort of nasty little minx, really, who gets her comeuppance. And it's really unpleasant. The way it talks about class is extremely unpleasant. And there are other novelists at the time, like Angela Thirkell, who's, you know, we think of as a light social, writing light social comedies. But actually, there's a nastiness to the way she talks about working class people and those post-war changes that really interested me. So I'd begun to want to write a novel that would address those sorts of issues. Wasn't quite sure, thought, could I kind of rewrite the franchise affair? That seemed quite appealing, you know, tell it from Betty's point of view, more sympathetically. And then I just began to think, hang on, maybe I could tell this as a haunted house novel. And that just immediately made me excited, partly because it meant I could really go for the genre and enjoy it. But also it just seemed to me that a haunted house was quite a good way of capturing this particular historical moment, you know, when Britain itself almost felt like this kind of creaky old haunted house that was resisting the pull into modernity and was being haunted by the relics of the past and the turmoil of the present and, you know, the uncertainty of the future. It was all sort of there. So it just produced the novel very naturally after that, yeah.
Mm. Betty is still has a
Betty's
presence
still
in
there. Yeah. But just in a much more reduced level than I imagined at the start. Because Dr. Faraday then came in. I wanted him at the start to be this rather in sort of transparent narrator. You know, lots of classic ghost stories have a figure a bit like Dr. Faraday, a sort of, he's slightly on the outside of the action, he's sympathetic, a bit bewildered, and really kind of, you know, gives this this account of a decline that he's not really a part of and doesn't understand. And I saw Dr. Faraday as playing that kind of role, telling us about this family's awful decline and not understanding it. But then I became interested in him and what might be going on for him. And I gave him this complicated class background of his own. So his mother has actually been a servant at the big house, Hundreds Hall, that's now in decline. And he started as a working class boy who was, you know, got scholarships and become a doctor. So he has an uneasy relationship with his own past, not quite accepted by the gentry class as one of them, and has this kind of odd love-hate relationship with Hundreds Hall and what it represents. So he both wants it and hates it. And it just seemed full of wonderful narrative potential. So poor Betty then ended up, I mean, she's still there and she's got quite a nice role in lots of ways. But she's a much smaller character than I intended her to be.
She's fabulous in the film.
She's
I loved brilliant her every time
film.
She's on screen.
Liv Hill plays her and she's still really young, Liv. I think she went back, you know, to finish off her A-levels or something when they finished filming, and she's such a great actress.
Yeah.
And she really, yeah, she brings a lot to that role, actually.
So that ambiguity that exists in Faraday, in that you see him really admiring Hundreds Hall and the family, the heirs that live there, but he also hates them because he's not part of them. And it's so interesting that he's a doctor. I mean, for one, in the film, there's a mention of the newly formed NHS, and he's debating with a colleague about that. We sort of come in halfway through that conversation. But also because as a doctor, he's a very respected figure in society, but he still has to work. And so he's not part of this
leisured class.
Yeah, exactly. And it's such an ambiguous novel in many ways. I mean, when we're talking about a ghost story, there's this plot thread throughout that it's possible that this house is being haunted by a dead child, one of the heir's children. But then it becomes much more twisted than that, doesn't it? It sort of starts looking at perhaps whether there's some sort of manifestation of Faraday himself prompting violence in the house. And I sort of see that like an ambiguous novel is something that is something that appeals to a lot of readers, even though it might frustrate some because some people just want answers, you know. But it also strikes me that an ambiguous film is something that's perhaps even more hard to sell to an audience.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I mean, I wanted him to be a doctor because doctors are very mobile characters. I needed a reason for him to keep going to the hall, basically, you know, and he is into the hall is that he goes there to treat Betty with this kind of sham complaint and then ends up treating Roderick for the leg that's been injured during the war and then gradually sort of becomes this confidant to the family, you know. And doctors are great because they have to be incredibly dispassionate, but they're also, you know, they have intimate knowledge about us. So I really liked that sense that he has this very logical, rational surface, but that he gets involved with the family in much more sort of intricate ways. And of course, he himself has this unconscious side to him that is really, I guess, the heart of all the troubles. But I certainly, as you say, I wanted to keep things a bit ambiguous, which you can do in a novel. I was interested in this as a story about poltergeist rather than about ghosts, you know, poltergeist being distinct from ghosts as being a sort of bundle of energy acting out distress and anger and all those messy feelings that we find hard to admit rationally, you know, can burst out. This was the idea I had. I really liked that. And to a certain extent, I wanted the novel to be a kind of, well, whose poltergeist is it? You know, is it Betty the servant maid, the kind of classic poltergeist focus? Is it Caroline, who's this rather frustrated woman who's been brought back to look after the house and the family? She doesn't really want to be there. You know, is it Roderick, who's been kind of emasculated by his wartime injury and feels... you know, he's struggling to maintain his status and his role as head of the household. So they're all unhappy and traumatized in one way or another. But yeah, gradually I wanted it to emerge that the poltergeist or whatever the problem is has a rather different source to that. And it's, you're right about film. That was one of the conversations I had with Lucinda Coxon, the scriptwriter. You know, how you could capture that ambiguity and without frustrating an audience. You didn't want an audience to leave kind of just scratching their heads and not taking anything else away from a film, but bafflement. You know, other choices that had to be made were which of the spooky scenes could you show on screen, because in the novel, Dr. Faraday himself never really experiences anything supernatural. It's all reported to him by other people and he reports it to us, but that would have meant for a lot of flashback scenes, you know. So there's Roderick has a very spooky experience early in the novel with a shaving mirror that kind of moves by itself, and that couldn't go into the film, unfortunately, because it was just kind of not right for the narrative line of the movie. And I think actually in the end, Lenny the director and Lucinda the scriptwriter did just a brilliant job of retaining enough ambiguity to make the film feel complex and subtle and thought-provoking, you know, without feeling frustrating, without feeling like it sort of missed its mark. And certainly the final image in the film, which is much more explicit really than any resolution in the novel, I think it's just so spot on though. It just absolutely gets the novel. It's very poignant. It's kind of more poignant really than I'd guessed it could be, and I really felt that when I was watching it myself. I was, you know, it's a story about people being stuck, unable to evolve. You know, here they all are in this house, including Dr. Faraday, in a country that's changing at a fast pace around them. But they're, you know, the heir's family wanting to keep alive this kind of lost world that's just crumbling away. Faraday is enthralled to that world, even though he thinks he isn't really. And they're just kind of stuck there. And this is the final image of this endless kind of playing out of a sort of unhappy moment in the life of the characters and the life of the film. And I thought that was just brilliantly done.
I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, just based on numbers, I mean, so many of your books have been adapted in various ways. I mean, even with The Fingersmith, that's been adapted, I think, for TV, for theatre and for film now with The Handmaiden. But are you someone that is quite happy for someone to adapt your novels, in that you're quite happy to see what emerges and it's distinct from what you had originally produced?
Yeah, very much. In fact, I mean, I've liked all the adaptations, and I've really loved seeing it happen, seeing what choices a scriptwriter has to make. You know, what can work in a novel and what can't quite work on a film. The characters that have to go because there isn't room for them in a TV program or a film. So I've just enjoyed really handing them over to somebody else. I mean, once I know, you know, I have to know beforehand that they're not going to muck around with the novel, not sort of do damage to the novel or to my intentions with the novel. But actually, I mean, I think in a way the adaptations I've enjoyed the most have been the ones, like, I mean, you mentioned The Handmaiden, which was just a glorious treat, I thought, of a film, and is so true to the novel and yet does its own thing as well. You know, it's very much the director Park Chan-wook's own film, own vision. And I've really enjoyed it when adaptations have done that, when they've used the book but turned the book into something of their own. And I think The Little Stranger does that too. It's very much Lenny's film and Lucinda's film, even while it's still incredibly faithful to the novel.
Working with Lenny, I was listening to an old interview with him recently, actually, just after Room came out, which is Emma Donoghue's novel. And he said how someone recommended the novel to him and he went and read it and then loved it so much, he then went and wrote a 10-page letter to her.
Really?
About, like, why he loved it and why he should be the one to direct it. I think at that point he actually didn't know that there was a screenplay floating around, but he really wanted to be involved in whatever was going to be done with this novel. And Emma Donoghue said it struck her that he really got her novel. So what was it like for you working with Lenny? Because he just having watched a few of his films, I'm thinking of Frank, which is based on a John Ronson mm-hmm. news article, but also Room. He's a man that works very well with written content in terms of turning it into a film, but respecting the material.
Yes. And, you know, I had a very similar experience to Emma. I was really, really impressed when I first had contact with Lenny by how well he knew The Little Stranger, the novel. You know, he was talking to me. He could, like, repeat whole sections of it to me. But also how he got it. I mean, that's what Emma said, isn't it? You know, how he just so clearly got what I was getting at. Because it's a novel that it is a bit ambiguous, and some readers have come away thinking, oh, hang on a minute, what, you know, where was that, what was going on there, and what is The Little Stranger, and which to a certain extent makes me feel like I must have failed as a writer, you know. But then when somebody comes along who really does get it, it's very, very satisfying, and I definitely had that feeling with Lenny. And also I'd seen some of his short films at that point and knew he was a really, really interesting director. So I just felt incredibly flattered that he'd had this response to the book and seen things in it that he really wanted to bring to life. It was very exciting, you know, that somebody of his ability, his talents and his stature was ready to devote time and thought and emotion to the book was just really wonderful. So it was a great experience working with him. I mean, I've never, with my adaptations, I've never been what you'd call creatively involved, but I've certainly usually been very included in the process. I like to see drafts of the script, and it was particularly interesting with The Little Stranger because there are these ambiguities, and I know that Lenny and Lucinda between them tried out slightly different endings.
Oh, really?
Yeah, slightly different strategies. There was, and it was interesting being part of or party to that conversation about what would be the best strategy to kind of get what they wanted to get. That was very interesting. So it was, it was a very rewarding experience.
And as far as I understand it, the paying guest is still in the works. Is that right? That there's an adaptation coming for that?
Yes. I mean, you never know with adaptations if they're going to come off or not. But it looks like this is going to happen for TV. Mm. I mean, The Paying Guest is much more suited to TV. It's slightly more episodic. There was something about The Little Stranger, I think, that suited that intense viewing experience. But yeah, touch wood, the paying guests will happen too.
Sarah Waters speaking there with Sian Kane. The Little Stranger, the novel that is published in paperback by Virago, and the film is out in the UK now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Last year, The Guardian tracked all the deaths of young people due to knife crime and explored the themes that emerged in an award-winning series called Beyond the Blade.
Why are they carrying a knife in an area where they know people but they feel that they have to acquit themselves from other people?
We saw many people suffering, but we also saw many fighting back.
We've got to start looking at how we talk and how we generalise and how we categorise just ordinary people that are poorer than other people or people who don't have as much as other people.
For this new series, journalists from The Guardian travel to Bristol, Birmingham and Croydon in South London to listen to some of those people.
Society tends to look down at young people once they've made a wrong choice, and what we're saying by that is that we're writing them off.
And rather than report on their conversations, we let them speak for themselves.
When I come out of jail, I'd never been praised before. I'd turned my life around. And when I come out and got praised for the work that I was doing, I thrived.
That gap needs to be built up a bit sooner, you know, as opposed to, yeah, just waiting to hear from me, because I'm waiting to hear from the next generation as well. So we're all waiting and there's no, like, action happening.
If families are fractured, that has an impact on a young person. If a father and a mother get divorced, that has an impact on our young people. And I think the only way they know how to make people sit up and say, listen, there's a real problem going on here, is by violence.
To listen to all three episodes, head over to theguardian.com/podcast or subscribe by searching Beyond the Blade on your favourite podcast app.
Good artists copy and great artists steal. So said Picasso, and he should know. It's a perennial point of discussion for writers too, and John Boyne explores it in his latest novel, A Ladder to the Sky. It follows the writing life of Maurice Swift, a young writer so obsessed with being remembered as being great that he will do anything, really anything, to lay claim to a new book. This is a novel about ambition, about legacy, throwing in some very funny observations of literary pretensions. Maurice himself says in the book, writers can be merciless. So Sian asked John, did he think he'd been merciless in his depiction of the writing world?
Well, it's not negative, though, either,
no.
I hope. You know, because, you know, I've been publishing books for almost 20 years. And actually, I love the publishing industry, and I think it's a very good industry. So it's not so much a satire on that as on the chap himself, you know, on Maurice, on somebody who has a degree of talent but no imagination, so cannot think up his own stories and the things that any of us might do, really, to get ahead and to succeed in life.
And he's so obsessed with being a novelist, but clearly he doesn't have... He has the drive to be a novelist, but he doesn't have the imagination to really fuel that. So he finds all sorts of ways to get around this and pilfer other people's ideas and their stories. What is that line for you between copying and stealing?
Well, firstly, with Maurice, it's not just the drive to be a novelist. It's the drive to be a famous novelist, which is sometimes the difference when it comes to writers and to new writers. Which of those two things is the most important to you? And the line between it for me, well, I mean, there is that question in the book about literary ownership, that if, you know, if you and I are sitting down and you tell me a story and you've just told me it, you know, does it still belong to you? Does it belong to me? Does it belong to the first person to write it down? It's very hard to know. I think it's almost on a case-by-case basis. In this novel, though, what Maurice is doing is he's actually manipulating people for their stories. So he's going about it in a very calculated way, which is different than, as I say, than you just say, telling me a story that I might sort of adapt then or use as the beginning of something. So there's the difference there in anything, whether we do it to manipulate people or whether we do it just out of just basic honesty.
And do you agree with Maurice's assessment that writers are merciless?
Well, I think they can be at times. I mean, we are all, you know, we're all fighting for readers, I suppose, and we're all fighting to write, you know, the very best book that we can write at any time. But I think for the most part, the best writers are those who sort of live, you know, generally quiet lives and are just at home writing their books and perhaps not worrying too much about what happens after publication, because so much of that is in the lap of the gods. You know, it's sometimes you get lucky with a book and sometimes you don't, and it's not always about the book itself. It's one will just take off in the way another one doesn't. But we should be merciless with our stories and with our writing and with our sentences, I think, you know, and trying to write the very best thing we can do every time.
And in terms of this line between stealing, copying, pure invention, is it something that's come up in your career very much? Have you ever had moments where someone's told you a fabulous story or perhaps just sort of told you an anecdote that in passing, not really thinking that you might be using it, and you're sort of right, a part of your mind switches on going, that's fabulous, I'd really use that in this way?
It probably has. You know, like any other writer, I suppose, I always have a notebook with me, and if I hear something, if something happens, I'll scribble it down, and maybe 99 out of 100 of those won't go anywhere, but one will. But I don't think I've ever heard something and felt, I'm going to take that deliberately in that way. The only difference, I suppose, would be that in the early part of my career, because I wrote a lot of historically based novels then, I was taking other people's stories and adapting them. I wrote a novel about Dr. Crippen, a novel about Captain Bligh. So I was taking stories that existed in the world and turning them into fiction in some way. Or in the case of the novel about Bligh, about the Bounty, really taking a story that we'd seen so many times on movies and trying to tell the truthful story, but in a novel, which is a weird way to do it, I suppose. But I'm sure people have told me things that have inspired a story or that have inspired a character or a scene in a book, but I've never felt I've done it in any sort of malevolent way.
No. And no one's ever laid claim ownership
to
it afterwards. No,
not so far.
I mean, there's a particular book that Morris writes, which is the first one, Two Germans, which he very blatantly takes a story that is told to him by a sort of more senior and elderly author called Eric about his youth. And all throughout the book, Morris justifies this by, when he's called out on it, that he always talks about, well, I changed certain things. And later on in the novel, he sort of more overtly says that he was told this, but he was never told that he couldn't use it. Do you think that there is anything that really is off limits to writers that they should ever take into account the personal feelings of others?
It's possible that there are some. I think in the case of Morris and Eric in this book, one thing I tried to do as the novel progressed, as you point out, is that every time he is challenged on it, I kind of tried to play devil's advocate a little bit to kind of ask that question of myself as a writer and to ask the reader, because the reader at that point is probably going to look at Morris in a very negative way. So I'm trying to have him debate people at times, answering that question, saying, but look, what did I actually do wrong here? A guy told me a story. He'd never written it himself. He didn't say it was, you know, off the record. And I have changed things. I have used a basic idea and turned it into a novel. Is that so bad? I only a couple of weeks ago, somebody on Twitter, in fact, criticized me for taking an inspiration, I suppose, shall we say, for this book from my own life and turning it into a novel. But isn't that what novelists have been doing since it all started? That we take something, you know, look at Philip Roth, you know, who spent his whole career writing novels based generally on people he knew and his own experiences as a writer. I think it comes down to whether you're doing it. You don't want to use novels as a form of revenge or, to give out about your ex or whatever. You know, you want to, but you can take something that is interesting that has happened to you and try to analyze why. When I wrote a couple of years back, I wrote a novel, A History of Loneliness, about the child abuse scandals in the church in Ireland. And while I was on the promotional campaign for that, you know, I talked about things that had happened to me as a kid growing up in that environment. And it's the same sort of thing. You know, you're taking something from your real life and finding a way to examine it and explore your own reaction to it and how it has affected your life.
You mentioned the true story that in ways inspired this book. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a small moment in its way, but it was, I guess, over these 20 years, I have seen the way people can attach themselves to others at times, sometimes not always for the most honourable of reasons. And I went through a bit of an experience like that myself a few years back, where I suppose I was in the Eric role and somebody was in the Morris Swift role. And it isn't based on that in any way, but it was more sort of, I came away from that experience feeling that maybe both of us had been dishonest in our relationship to each other. One person using a mid-career novelist to get introductions to this person or that person. And there was also the question of, well, what was I doing at that moment? Why was I sort of seduced and flattered by somebody's attentions? So I kind of used that idea to begin this novel. And in a way, I was probably more interested in Eric at the start, about why would somebody who was ostensibly, you know, doing okay with their lives, why do they need to be flattered? Why do we need to have our ego stroked all the time? And why is it so easy for somebody to come in and do that? So I was asking that of myself, but using that experience really as the basis for it.
And towards the end, Morris is always chasing fame, and he's always very excited. I mean, I laughed basically every single time there was a reference to the prize, capital T, capital P, which is never named, but we all know which one it is. And how he's sort of simultaneously obsessed with it, but also very keen to appear as if he's not bothered by the idea of it, which I think is something that is definitely something I've seen in some authors, including some authors that have actually won it, the prize.
What I always love is when people who are on the Booker long list or short list say they weren't even aware that the list was coming out.
Liars.
I just go, give me a break. Also, you know, the people who say they don't read the reviews.
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
They definitely all read the reviews.
Well, you also can't, in a way, in this day and age with the internet and everything, one way or another, you're going to get a sense of things like reviews. You're going to know. It's not like you have to go out and buy the newspaper. It's going to be online, you know, so you're going to find out. I remember John Banville, I love this line. He says, you know, if you get a bad review in the newspaper, you can rely on your best friend to phone you up and make sure you've seen it. You know, and that's the truth. You know, if I get a bad review, you know, I'll get out of bed and somebody will text and say, I'm so sorry about that in such and such a paper. And you go, oh God, what was it?
You have to go read it then, don't you?
But you kind of have to then, you know? Nobody ever texts and says, hey, well done on that review.
I mean, and so much of this book is about the pretensions of the literary world. So there's a particular very fateful run-in in the Hay Festival green room, I think, at one point. And then there is also Morris at one point is in charge of a literary magazine and sort of going through all the submissions and observing the interns that are really only there to try and get their stories in there as well, and this sort of thing. It strikes me though that you don't really seem, you said before that you're not really, you don't view the literary world and its pretensions as a negative thing or something to not engage with or avoid. I mean, it's probably hard not to.
You know, I've spent my life in it, so I do like it very much and admire it and respect it. I don't think it's any different to any other industry that you're going to find the odd person along the way who is a pain, you know, or is just, you know, doesn't behave as you would hope that they would behave. It's no different than anything else. I certainly never meant this to be a negative view of it, because there are a lot of people in the book who, at the start, for example, Eric, who has lived a life, published 6 novels that haven't really found readers, but actually has been rediscovered in later life. Somebody like Edith, who's Maris's wife in the second part of the book, has been discovered early on as a very talented, young, new writer. You know, there are people who are treated very well by the industry. I think Maris has this chip on his shoulder a lot of the way through it because he feels he isn't being treated well by it. But it still comes back to the fact, but you're not a very good writer.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, what does he want? He wants all the glory of it without actually having achieved.
Yeah, I mean, there's the references to his second novel, The Treehouse, which is constantly referred to as the sort of difficult second novel, but is the one that strikes you as maybe possibly the one that is most genuinely
It's the only novel book he writes which is completely written by himself, I think. You know, it's that nobody has given him any ideas. He's had to just write it himself, and it's been mediocre. Mm. And it has not succeeded because of that mediocrity. And his career has taken a dip. But of course, that's not always the case. You know, mediocrity rises to the top all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing that I love, that it is always brought up as sort of the one that people say they liked most if they're sort of trying to appear a little bit,
you know,
well-read.
Yeah. I think probably every writer probably has a book in their canon that if someone says they really like that one the best, you go, really? You did? You know, because you just know yourself, maybe it's the one that would be at the bottom of your own list.
Yeah.
But then it's also nice, you know, if somebody says it about that one, because it doesn't get as much love. So,
I mean, so much of this book feels like a thriller, and it's so utterly compelling. You just kind of, even if you hate Morris, you kind of want to see what he does next.
Well, I was thinking a lot about things like, you know, The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Mm. Ripley.
And even Hannibal Lecter. Mm. You know, those kind of sort of anti-heroes that you're kind of with them all the way. You just want to see how bad they're going to get. You know, what can he possibly do next? And even though you may not want to be friends with him in real life, you're kind of, at least I hope, if I've done it right, that the reader kind of falls from, in the way that, you know, everybody else falls from the book, because Morris keeps effectively seducing people one way or another. And I hope he kind of seduces the reader in that same way.
Well, it's funny that he doesn't really seem to have many obvious weaknesses in, perhaps maybe his ego, but he's utterly amoral. So he really just does whatever he wants and says whatever he wants. He's also very clever, very good looking. This is a fatal combination. And also,
I've suffered from it my whole life.
And also, you could probably describe him as asexual, which also
totally asexual
frees him up from being seduced himself.
Yeah, and that was the decision I made early on, because I knew he was going to be very attractive to everybody else, but that sex would play no role in his life at all. That he's just not interested. He's not into men. He's not into women. He'll be with either if he has to be, but it's just not a driving force in his life at all. So this is not a young man who says, if I'm a good looking famous writer, I'll get all the girls or something. This is not his motivation. So I just decided that early on to keep him completely asexual.
I mean, in the title of the book, A Ladder to the Sky, is a reference to a proverb about ambition. But it struck me as well, just based on how the book is structured, we sort of end up with Morris very late in his life, considering what his legacy might be. And he's actually part of that last part of this book is his interviews with a young student who's almost in a Morris role in a way, interviewing him for his thesis. Is this a book that you felt like you perhaps had to wait a little while to write, in a way, to sort of sort your ideas out about legacy and your own legacy?
Well, not so much legacy, but I couldn't, if you include all my children's books, it's my 16th novel.
Mm.
So I couldn't have written it early on, because I'd need to really understand what I'm writing about, really understand the industry that I'm talking about and the people I'm talking about. I think I'm a little young yet to be worrying about my legacy.
You've got a few more books in you.
Yeah, I hope I have another sort of 40 years or so. So I don't really think about that too much, other than the fact I know that when I die, it'll say, the author of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas died, regardless of what I've done between now and then. It's not going to make any difference. But that's okay. I think I'm not really worrying about that so much yet.
I mean, have you had any other writers read it and respond to it and the truths that they've found in it?
Yeah, quite a few. You know, I've had some good responses from writers so far. I found a couple of the younger writers are a little bit more negative about it, just because I am kind of calling out the pretensions a little bit. Mm. But I don't think in a cruel way. I'm sort of, it's a satire. I'm sort of teasing a little bit. It's just a bit of fun. But some people take it all so seriously, and there are things, you've seen over the years that will just make you laugh. I don't include it in the book, but like, for example, I know of a person who has 20/20 vision, has no problems with his eyesight, but when he gives readings, as he stands up at the lectern at a festival, will put on a pair of glasses that are actually see-through and take them off when he's finished reading. And it's things like that. There's hundreds of those kind of stories that you could tell. And those kind of things. You just, nobody's murdered anybody. It's not a life and death here. But it's just, funny. And you think, why do you need that level of pretension?
Mm.
Why can't we just let the books speak for themselves in that way, that you don't have to pretend to be somebody that you're not? You just let your stories, let your sentences, let your novels be themselves.
Sean Kane was speaking with John Boyne. A Ladder to the Sky is out now, published by Doubleday. Next week, we go exploring. Simon Reeve takes us step by step through some of his journeys to the far corners of the earth, and Neil McGregor helps make sense of the world with his next coffee table must-have, Living with the Gods, on beliefs and peoples. In the meantime, you can subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and join the discussion on Twitter or by leaving a comment on the podcast's page. As always, if you prefer to contact us directly, you can email us at bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.